Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Stephen Kane, who's a professor of physics and astronomy at San Francisco State University, whose primary research interest is detecting and characterizing planets outside our solar system. He is among a team of international researchers who recently discovered a planet similar to Earth that could support life. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Kane.
Thank you, Ian. I'm glad to be here.
And this planet called Kepler-186f is in what's called the Goldilocks zone. And that means, I guess, it could support life, meaning that it's not too hot or not too cold. I must say, for such a significant discovery to something similar to the Earth, the name is not exactly romantic, shall we say?
I know. I totally agree, Ian. It has a very uninspiring name. Unfortunately, that's due to a way in which we're naming planets at the moment is due to the fact that we are simply discovering so many. This is a glass is half full way of looking at it, I guess, in that we're discovering so many of these kinds of planets that we need a systematic way of naming them. And the way that we do name them is that they're named after the star, and a lot of these stars are faint enough that they don't have an actual name that we're more familiar with, but they have a catalog-sounding name. So unfortunately, that means that they do end up sounding like the license plate of your car.
Yeah, and this the Kepler significance is the NASA telescope, which is the means by which you see these distant planets, right? This is a telescope that's in space.
Yes, that's right. In fact, it's not even orbiting the Earth, like for example, the Hubble Space Telescope is. The Kepler telescope is in what's called an Earth-trailing orbit, meaning that it's in the same orbit as the Earth, but following the Earth around the Sun. And the advantage of doing that is that it means it can point at the same area of the sky continuously, which is what it's been doing for the past 5 years.
So just literally data is just pouring in, is that what's happening? That you're seeing so much you can barely keep up?
Actually, that's a very apt way of putting it. There is so much interesting data and so much content in that data that we really struggle to keep up. And there's a lot of people who are working on this trying to make sense of all the new discoveries that are coming out of it. And there are some very interesting discoveries, such as the latest announcement of the Earth-sized planet in the habitable zone.
And when you say it's Earth-sized, it's, what, 10% bigger than the Earth?
Yes, that's right. The interesting thing about this system, because this system has five planets that we know of in it, and all of these planets are between 1 and 1.5 Earth radii, which means that they're all probably terrestrial, meaning that they're rocky, like we're familiar with the terrestrial planets of our own solar system. But this particular one, the outermost planet in the Hubble zone, is 1.1, which, as you said, means it's about 10% larger than the Earth. And the Kepler mission has discovered Earth-sized planets before. It's also discovered planets in the habitable zone before, but this is the first time that we've been able to put those two crucial ingredients together, and that is an Earth-sized planet in the habitable zone. So it's quite a milestone for the Kepler mission and its discoveries.
And this planet with the name of Kepler-186f is orbiting a star that's 500 light years from the Earth, and it's a what's called a cool red dwarf, which is about half the size of our Sun. Elaborate on that, if you will.
Sure. Well, the orbital period of the outer planet, meaning the time it takes for the planet to orbit the star, is about 130 days, and that doesn't sound very Earth-like. But the difference is, as you say, it's orbiting quite a different star from our Sun. It's a much smaller and it's a much cooler star, which means that the habitable zone, which is what you described earlier, the Goldilocks zone, it's the region around the star where water could feasibly be in a liquid state on the surface of the planet. So that means that that is closer to the star than it would be for our own Sun, because the star is cooler. And so that means that this planet is orbiting in the Hubble zone of its star. Now, the good news, another piece of good news about this, is that this kind of star, a red dwarf star, that's the most common type of star in the universe. These small types of stars are much more common than even our own Sun. And so that means if there's many more systems like this, and these stars themselves are extremely common, that could very well mean that planets like this, Earth-sized planets in the Hubble zone, are quite common indeed.
And again, I'm speaking with Stephen Kane, who's a professor of physics and astronomy at San Francisco State University, whose primary research interest is detecting and characterizing planets outside our solar system. He's among a team of international researchers who recently discovered a planet similar to Earth that could support life. So how do you, as given the extraordinary distances involved here, with the use of this NASA's Kepler Space Telescope, How do you determine whether it could possibly have liquid water, and what's the significance of the planets being rocky?
Right. So the first thing to mention is that the way in which the Kepler telescope provides data with which we can discover these planets is using something called the transit technique. And what that means is that whenever a planet passes in front of its star, between us and the star, it blocks out some of the light of the star. So what we observe when we're looking at the star is that the star gets dimmer for a brief period. And the amount of light which is blocked depends on how big the planet is. A bigger planet will block more light, a smaller planet will block less light. And so what we end up with is a direct measurement of the radius of the planet. And this is crucial because it allows us to determine, based on both the radius and the mass, what the average density is. And what we tend to find is that planets which are smaller than around about 1.5 Earth radii have a rocky composition. And that allows us to put it within the context of the terrestrial planets that we're familiar with, especially planets like the Earth. And the other vital piece, which is provided by the Hubble zone, is calculated based on the amount of energy that planet receives, depending on how close it is to its star and what the properties of the star are. Like I mentioned, this star is a lot smaller and a lot cooler, which means it can be much closer. So those two pieces together means that it could have the right temperature and pressure at the surface of the planet such that it could have this water in a liquid state. And of course, the reason that we're interested in water is that we know water has had such a crucial role in the development of life on the Earth. That's why we're always following the water. It's an extremely common hydrogen compound, and hydrogen and oxygen are themselves very common, and so it gives us great confidence that could also be used to facilitate life elsewhere.
But the other planets that you mentioned that NASA's Kepler space-based telescope has discovered, There are what, three exoplanets that are larger than the Earth, and that they're within this habitable zone. But what's the difference then? One was, I think, 40% larger than Earth. So tell me about these earlier ones and why this latest discovery is more exciting than these previous discoveries.
Well, the reason this is more exciting is simply because we feel that we understand planets about which are about the size of the Earth better than anything which is about 40 to 50% larger. Because an interesting feature of our own solar system is that the very largest terrestrial object is, of course, the Earth. Once you go beyond that size, the next largest object is Neptune, which is about 3.8 Earth radii. But we have nothing in between. We have nothing which is 2 Earth radii, nothing which is 1.5. And so we struggle to understand what these objects might be like, even though they're extremely common elsewhere. And so what we do suspect, based on what we've determined from the average densities of other similar kinds of objects which are about 40% larger or 50% larger, that once you reach the 1.5 Earth radii point, the gravity of those planets starts to become large enough that it will accumulate a hydrogen-helium-dominated atmosphere. What that means is that it will start to resemble something like a gas giant rather than the terrestrial planets that we're familiar with, a gas giant like the composition of Jupiter and Saturn. And so objects which are at that threshold or close to it, we feel that we understand less. Now, these previous discoveries of Kepler, like Kepler 62E and F, which, as you mentioned, are around about 40% larger than Earth, they could still well have conditions at the surface which are which is suitable for the development of life. They could well do, but we are trying to accurately determine what the fraction of stars that have planets which are the size of the Earth, simply because that is our starting reference point.
But it's there are some fundamental differences, though, are there not with this new Earth-like planet? It doesn't have the day and night cycles that we have, does it? It's permanently sunny on one side and permanently dark on the other.
Yes, that is certainly true. We don't know that for certain, but what we do know that an unfortunate side effect of being in the habitable zone around a red dwarf star is that because you are much closer, then you do tend to become tidally locked in the same way that the same side of the moon is always facing to the Earth. You can have a situation where the same side of the planet is always facing the star. And it's an interesting thought experiment to think about what that does for habitability. What would habitability on the Earth be like if there was one side of the Earth which was in perpetual night? And we don't know for certain about how that would affect things like the atmosphere and the development of life. And we don't know for certain that this planet is tidally locked, but the chances of that happening do certainly increase with a planet like this, which is so close to its star.
So you could grow a lot of tomatoes on one side and nothing on the other, right?
Yes. The dark side of the planet certainly would have a problem with basic photosynthesis, for example,
right,
which would allow you to grow any significant vegetable gardens.
So, but obviously this fascination with an Earth-like planet or one that has potentially could support life, I think the subtext surely in this whole thing, Stephen Kane, is this idea surely that people continually, not just the people that listen to radio at 2 a.m. And wondering when the UFOs are coming or how many are already on the planet, but apart from the UFO speculations, there is this whole idea that maybe there's an exit strategy from the Earth. Maybe there's somewhere else we can go, like pioneers, you know, like crossing the Great Plains and finally making it to Oregon, that we could somehow migrate to greener pastures.
Absolutely. And certainly having the knowledge now that there are possible other reservoirs of life, if you like, that they are out there, and more so, it seems that they're very plentiful. Having that knowledge now will certainly motivate us towards the future of exploration, of going to these places and finding out actually what's going on, and trying to answer the question which has been bothering philosophers for thousands of years, about the question of if there is indeed other life in the universe. Can it independently evolve somewhere else? And people like Socrates and Bruno, who tried to address these questions, would be extremely envious of the current generation that now has the technological capability in our hands to actually try and answer some of these fundamental questions.
But isn't there a long way between what you have just been able to do by detecting this far-off planet using this NASA's space-based Kepler telescope? There's a big distance between seeing it for the first time and getting there, right? 500 light years.
Yes.
I mean,
there's two ways of looking at that. I mean, our galaxy is 100,000 light years in diameter, so 500 light years should just be a quick trip around the block. On the other hand, for a civilization which hasn't progressed, at least in manned spaceflight, beyond its own moon, there is some significant technology gateways that need to be passed through before we can even consider heading to a place which is 500 light years. But one thing to keep in mind, of course, is that at the moment we're just on a information gathering mission, and we're trying to determine what the frequency of these kinds of planets are, which means that if we determine that the frequency is high, then there's a very high likelihood that there are many more of these kinds of planets which are much closer to us. Still, it'll be a challenge to reach something which is 10 light years away, but it's not quite as overbearing as the thought of having to figure out how to traverse a distance of 500 light years.
Well, I remember years ago having a conversation with Carl Sagan about this because, you know, he was a wonderfully optimistic person.
Yes, he was.
And I said, well, how, you know, if you could find a place, and obviously back then they hadn't discovered what you've just discovered, but how would you get there? And given that you could never live that long, and there's certainly not any fuel available that could take you that long distance. But he mentioned, well, there's a possibility of that you could travel faster than light with wormholes. And what's the latest on that?
Oh, I haven't heard any developments in that area, unfortunately. But as soon as there are any breakthroughs in that regard, I'll be the first to sign up.
Right. So we're really, this is science fiction, right? With the idea that you could find another way to get there.
Unfortunately, at this point, as far as I'm aware, the physics has just not matured to that point. I mean, the thing that is clear is that with current physics, we talk about it would take hundreds of years even to reach the nearest stars, which are only a few light years away. And so to do anything different will require brand new physics. So we need to move beyond our current understanding of physics and faster than light travel.
Well, just in closing then, what is the significance in terms of physics of this discovery, given that it's a long way off and people's fantasies are being fed by this idea, but that's not realistic. But surely there are other benefits apart from speculating about life on other planets.
Well, the main thing that we are learning from Kepler, as I mentioned earlier, that the technique which Kepler uses gives us a direct measurement of the size of the planets. And so the main thing which I say that we have learned from Kepler is that we've learned about the distribution of different sizes. Because, of course, in the early days, we were only finding the giant planets. But what we've found is that as our sensitivity of our instruments continues to increase and we dig deeper and deeper, what we find is, in hindsight, the relatively surprising result that the smaller you look in terms of planet radius, the more you find of them. The analogy I tend to make is if you look at a pile of rubble, you have a couple of the large boulders, you have more of the large rocks, and then you have many more of the smaller rocks. By the time you get to the pebbles and grains of sand, there's just too many to count. And that seems to be the way it works with planet formation, that that terrestrial-sized planets are a natural consequence of star formation. And that's great news because it means that we can expect that pretty much all of the stars that we see in the sky probably have terrestrial-sized planets, some of which will be in the Hubble zone, and this gives us great inspiration for knowing that when we're looking at the stars, we're almost certainly looking at a whole host of planetary systems.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Stephen Kane.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Stephen Kane, who's a professor of physics and astronomy at San Francisco State University, whose primary research interest is detecting and characterizing planets outside our solar system. He is among a team of international researchers who recently discovered a planet similar to Earth that could support life. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Land here on the
my head.